Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. 3 weeks from today is Election Day. In addition to choosing a candidate for president and state offices, Massachusetts voters will weigh in on 5 ballot questions, and Barnstable County residents will be asked to weigh in on a 6th question, which we're going to discuss later in the hour. To talk more about the 5 statewide ballot questions, we invited Evan Horowitz, executive director of Tisch College's Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. The center provides nonpartisan research on the ballot questions and does not take positions on initiatives. Evan Horowitz, thanks for being with us. Welcome.
I'm Mindy. It's great to be here and talk through the ballot questions as people get ready to vote.
Yeah. So, give us a little bit of background on the Massachusetts ballot initiative process. What steps need to be taken before an initiative even makes it onto the ballot?
Well, let me say first, we've been doing this for a long time, right? We've had ballot questions in Massachusetts for over 100 years. Sometimes we have 3 questions. Sometimes we have 10 questions. This time we have 5. It is hard to get a question on the ballot and before voters. It takes a lot of money, takes a lot of time, takes a lot of organizing. So the questions voters are going to see in the next couple of weeks have been moving forward for the better part of 2 years. There's a long process of collecting signatures. We're talking tens of thousands of signatures. You need to get your language approved by the Attorney General, because you could imagine some of these things might not even be constitutional. So they have to pass a legal threshold. And then there are more signatures. And then often they're challenged in the courts. And then there's final sign-off. It takes a long time, but, you know, that part of the process is over, and now it's just time for voters to figure out where they stand.
Since you mentioned challenge in the courts, if a ballot initiative passes, can it still be contested in the courts?
Not only can it be contested, it can be overridden by the legislature as soon as they want. These are just laws. Mm-hmm. They have no special force just because we voted on them. They're laws, statutes like any other statute. So the minute they come into force, right, after they are passed, say, by voters, then they can be changed, they can be challenged, they can be amended, they can be repealed, just like any other law.
Yeah. And sometimes we see non-binding and binding. So in a non-binding question, it really is more like somebody wants to make a statement, right? Wants to let somebody know where people stand on a particular issue. Is that what that means?
Yeah, it's expressive. It's advisory. You know, we want the legislature to know we feel this way, or we want the state to take these actions. But the 5 we're talking about, these are binding, right? They will take effect. They will change the laws of the land.
All right. And listeners, if you have a question or comment about the 5 statewide ballot questions, you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, or you can give us a call, 866-999-4626. All right, let's start with question 1. Should the auditor oversee the legislature? First, what does the state auditor do, and what powers do they have or not have?
Yeah, I usually start before that. First, we have a state auditor. You know, lots of people don't know this. Why would they? Because there's no federal auditor. You know, lots of kind of state institutions mirror the federal institutions. We have an attorney general, right? 2 bodies in the legislature. But we also have an auditor, and lots of states do. They don't do financial audits. So don't think IRS, looking at numbers. That is not the job of the state auditor. The state auditor's job is to make sure that the departments of government, the governor's office, like the Department of Health and Human Services or Education Department, they are following their own rules and following their own rules for things like hiring staff. Are they taking the proper procedures? Buying office furniture. I like this example because, you know, it's very concrete. They're going to buy office chairs. They can't just like go to Staples. They have to follow a set of procedures to make sure they're getting the best price and the right number and things like that. So the auditor can examine these things. The auditor has a lot of power over executive agencies. The auditor is an executive branch, belongs to the executive branch, and has a lot of power over executive branch departments. She can get records. She can say, I need your records, all of your records about buying office furniture. I want to make sure you're doing it the right way. And those departments have to say, yeah, okay, here they are. Or the courts will come in and say, no, you have to give them the records. But her powers stop there. She doesn't have the power right now to say to the legislature, we want to see how you're buying office furniture. We want to know what you guys are doing. And this ballot question would change that. It would say, at least nominally, that she has the same authority over the legislature to require kind of their compliance with audit requests as she has with executive agencies.
So let's get the arguments, the yes and the no. So what are the arguments for the yes vote?
Well, even before we get to the arguments, let me say the likely impact. Our assessment is, even if the law nominally gives her this authority, she's not really going to be able to use it, or it's unlikely, let's say, that she'll be able to use it. And there are 2 main reasons for this. The first is constitutional. There are certain things that the legislature does that are core to its powers. It makes laws. It decides who's on which committee. It decides how to meet and how to record and how to vote. So Those things are core legislative prerogatives and constitutionally protected. So there's no law you can pass that will say, oh, you have access to those kinds of decisions. You can adjust those decisions. No, there's a separation of powers concern. The auditor will never be able to look at those kinds of things. And frankly, those are the things voters care most about, right? Those are the things, if voters are upset with the legislature, those are the things they care about. Why are they passing laws in the middle of the night? Why does it seem to be so much backroom dealing? And the auditor will never get authority over those things. Now, there's another class of things that she might, like the office furniture purchases. There's nothing constitutionally sacred about the legislature's purchasing of office furniture. Having said that, but the legislature doesn't want to comply with the auditor's request. If they wanted to, they just could. Mm-hmm. And so they can use all of their powers to resist. They can, for instance, defund the auditor's office. They're the ones who provide funding for all of her work. So they can either defund or just say, none of your money can be used to audit the legislature. And then she doesn't really have much recourse. So there's an outside chance where if all the stars align and she gets the attorney general on her side, maybe she can look into some things like maybe she could look into some things like the office furniture purchases, but we think that's pretty unlikely.
Yeah. So what are the arguments for the yes and then the no vote?
So the argument for the yes vote is the legislature is not as transparent as we want it to be. The auditor herself stands firmly behind this question. She has been advocating for this question, and she thinks that this will resonate with voters who are frustrated with the operations of the legislature. The no side is saying basically, well, I should say there isn't really an this is an unusual question in that there isn't an organized no side. There's no group that has raised money and has put together a campaign. The legislature could have done that. They declined to do that. I think the fact that they declined is a sign of how confident they are that they don't have to fight this, and that she won't gain, the auditor won't gain any new authority over them. But insofar as people are making the no argument, is that this is a breach of the constitutional order. It would give the auditor too much power, and it won't work anyway.
Yeah. All right, let's go to question two, which would be eliminating the MCAS graduation requirement. I imagine there's a lot of talk on this one. There's a lot of people who feel yes, a lot of people who feel no, right? So
This has a more traditional kind of setup in terms of support and opposition. You've got the business community mostly organized or loosely organized on the no side. You've got the teachers union strongly organized on the yes side. And so this is like a much more conventional kind of setup for a ballot question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, and for those who don't already know, the Massachusetts public school students need to pass the 10th grade MCAS exam to get a diploma. So who is behind this ballot initiative? You mentioned, is it the Teachers Association that's behind this?
Yeah, it's the Teachers Union that has been advancing this ballot question.
All right.
Though I should say, I think the best way for voters to think about this is not really as a question about the MCAS, though that's obviously what people are talking about. It is a question principally about whether the state should have any role in deciding who can graduate from high school. So right now, if you're in a public high school, you need sign off from your local district. That is, you have to meet the district standards for graduation. You also have to meet the state standards for graduation. And usually the MCAS is the way to meet the state standard. But what this ballot question does, it would say, no, there won't be a state test. There won't be any state vetting. The districts will certify that their standards meet the sort of curricular expectations of the state. And they make that certification, and that is it. So it's not about the MCAS in the sense that the state couldn't say, oh, we have a new test. Mm-hmm. No, they would not be able to say that. They can't say, oh, well, we're going to require high school students to pass these courses in this order in order to graduate. No, they would not have the authority to say that either. So it is broader than just the MCAS.
Yeah. And so it would be what each school district making up its own standard wouldn't be a statewide standard. It would be each district making their own requirements for graduation.
Exactly. There are over 300 districts. Each district would set its own requirements for graduation. Now, the ballot question says each district has to certify that those requirements reflect sort of state standards. That means like expectations for skills and what kids are supposed to learn. But it's not clear how that will be enforced. Like, let's say the state feels that a district has certified a set of standards that aren't properly reflective, that aren't. Mm-hmm. It's not clear they have the authority to oversee that or check that. Or bring it to court.
Yeah. Now, we hear from some that the MCAS is unfair to special needs students and English language learners who struggle with the MCAS. What did your research find?
So there is a small group of kids. So like, think again of this framework where if you want to graduate from high school, you have to meet your district requirements and meet the state requirements. So one question you might ask is, how many kids are meeting the district requirements but failing the MCAS or otherwise failing to meet the state requirements? And it's a small number of kids. It's about 700 kids a year. That's less than 1%. But a lot of those kids are struggling with the kind of challenges that you bring up, mental health challenges, cognitive disabilities, or English language learning. Remember, one of the MCAS tests is an English test. It is not a literacy test. You cannot take this test in Spanish and prove that you are a master of Spanish literature. That is not good enough to graduate from high school right now. So yeah, if you're not prepared to pass an English fluency test, the state has decided you're not ready to graduate from high school. That's bigger than the test. Mm-hmm. That is, we have an expectation about English fluency for our high school graduates. Maybe that's a mistake, but that's a broader question than the test. But it's certainly true that those kids have a harder time meeting the state standards than other kids.
Yeah. So how might eliminating the MCAS graduation requirement change what is taught in the classroom? We hear a lot about teaching to the test. Is that accurate?
So I think the teachers envision a world where without this, now the test's still going to happen. Kids will still take this test. It just won't be the graduation standard, but that will lower the stakes. So with these lower stakes for the test, teachers and districts will be free to reevaluate their teaching, really focus on the needs of their students, organize the community to see what they care about. I mean, that's the world the teachers envision. And I think for sure there are districts with the resources and the expertise to do that. What the opponents worry about is the districts that don't have the resources and the expertise. And for all the good teachers, not all teachers are good teachers. What happens to the teachers who are struggling in the classroom and who really relied on the test to kind of ground their focus in the classroom and their curriculum and what they were teaching their kids? So teaching to the test cuts both ways, depending on which side of this question you fall on. Mm-hmm. For the teachers, they think of it as a distraction from the real work of education. For the opponents, they think, no, it's a good test. The test has been proven to measure future success or to correlate with future success. Teaching to the test is a way to ensure we are teaching kids the things we want them to learn.
Okay. We have a listener comment that says, one good role that the MCAS can play is to force local school systems to provide a thorough education. In particular, if a learning disabled child is not able to achieve to the extent of receiving a high school diploma, the school system is required by Massachusetts law to financially support their continued education through age 21. For example, the system can pay the tuition for an excellent program such as Project Forward at Cape Cod Community College. In order to save money, towns are motivated to grant diplomas even to inappropriate students to dump them out of the system so the town does not have to pay for such a program. If the student fails the MCAS, the parents can demand the continuing support. Would this change the way that's funding? I mean, special needs students, the school system, they have to pay to age 21, right? Whether that's high school or somewhere else.
I don't know the details of how this would affect funding, but it speaks to a broader issue that sort of gets written out by this focus on the MCAS, which is that there are already a number of alternate pathways for kids. The MCAS is not the only high stakes exam that matters for kids graduating high school. There are other ways that the state evaluates and takes care of kids who either can't pass the MCAS or need an alternate path to graduate. Now, the representatives of the state, like from the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, are the first to admit that some of these paths need a lot of work. Like, they involve kind of peer review. Are you doing as well as your peers in your districts, or portfolio review, which puts a lot of pressure on the individual districts. But they have been working to build out these paths for kids that they know will struggle with the MCAS and who need alternatives to get through high school or support beyond high school.
We're talking about the 5 statewide ballot questions. If you have a comment or a question, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the 5 statewide ballot questions with Evan Horowitz, Executive Director of Tisch College's Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. The center provides nonpartisan research on ballot questions and doesn't take positions on initiatives. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Damien writes, he lives in East Ham. Our ballot has 2 additional questions. Question 6, which we're going to get to a little bit later in the hour. And question seven, he says, shall the state representative from this district be instructed to vote in favor of legislation that would support the development of South Coast Wind and Commonwealth Wind and other possible future offshore and onshore wind power and developments in Massachusetts? I can find very little guidance on these. Can you address them? And this goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about binding versus non-binding. This is a non-binding question.
Exactly. This is the kind of question where you're sending a message to representatives, but you're not changing the laws. It's certainly outside the scope of the law to tell individual representatives how to vote on future laws. That is definitely ruled out.
All right. Question three is the option for a union for rideshare drivers. So I guess current law, Uber and Lyft drivers in Massachusetts cannot readily form unions, right? So question three could change that. So what are the thoughts on this?
Yeah, so they can't form unions because they're not employees. They're considered independent contractors. And independent contractors can't negotiate together because that raises anti-competitiveness concerns, collusion. They're basically independent businesses working together. The exception is if the state steps in and says, you know what, we're going to suspend our concerns about collusion. We're going to allow them to negotiate together. We'll set up a whole framework that will make it work. We'll have the drivers or representatives of the drivers on one side of the table all together. We'll have the companies on the other side of the table. So think Uber and Lyft, because that's what we're talking about here, not DoorDash, but really just the rideshare companies on the other side of the table. And they'll come to an agreement about terms for the whole industry, right? Not for individual companies. They'll set standards for wages, standards for working conditions for the whole sector, including new companies that come in. And so this kind of is called sector-based bargaining or sectoral bargaining. And that's the framework that the state envisions through question three. It's pretty novel. No state has done this. There are examples around the world, but it would be a kind of first in the nation effort here in Massachusetts to create a path to unionization for these drivers.
So who's behind this ballot initiative and who's behind the opposition?
There's a union, a local union that has since gotten support more broadly. So it's a kind of union backed effort. They've been trying to organize drivers, rideshare drivers for a long time. And on the no side, you would expect a lot of activity from Uber and Lyft. There's been kind of surprisingly little opposition material and opposition activity on this question. But I think if it passes, you should expect to see a lot more. One reason is that it is a first of its kind effort, and there probably will be copycats, and the companies will be concerned about that. And not just Uber and Lyft, but other companies. There was a similar effort attempted in Seattle in 2015, 2016 around their rideshare. And that effort drew court challenges, including from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, so national court challenges to a city ordinance. And I think you should expect to see something similar here because it would represent a major change and a major innovation in the unionization effort for the gig economy.
If the initiative were to pass, could this union be included in another transportation union, or would it just be specific to the Uber?
So they could organize and try to get representation that sort of matched with other unions. But it really is going to be a special thing because even the bargaining rules will be different. For instance, the agreements that they come to across this table between the industry and the drivers will not be binding in themselves. They have to be approved by the state before they take effect. That's pretty unusual as a setup, but it's one of the requirements to make this function legally and to limit the kinds of challenges that blunted the effort in Seattle.
There's also the thought that some folks are saying if it passes, it's likely that passengers would see an increase in ride costs. Did your research show anything on that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what you should expect. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it passes, the first order effect is that it's likely to improve working conditions for drivers. They're likely to see higher wages. That money's got to come from somewhere. Some of it could come out of the profits of the companies, and it might, but some of it is going to come out of the pockets of riders. So rides are likely to get more expensive, and you know that will limit some of the benefits of this industry, which has proved really beneficial for consumers. Mm-hmm. Riders who get rides to the airport or get pickups at the bar have cut down on drunk driving and produced a number of other welfare benefits. And those are really not central to this question. That is, the question is very explicit, not just about the need to create this union or path to unionization, but the desire to help workers increase their wages. It says little to nothing about the desire to maintain a healthy and affordable rideshare industry.
Yeah. And if passed, as you kind of mentioned, this sector-based bargaining is untested and likely to face some legal challenges if it does pass, right?
I mean, that's our expectation, is that this probably will not take effect immediately. Even if it passes, it will be challenged in the courts, and you could see kind of years of legal wrangling around it.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a question about the ballot questions, 866-999-4626. Our email is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, question four. This would allow for the limited legalization and regulation of certain natural psychedelic substances. So tell us who's behind this initiative and who's opposed to it.
So this initiative comes from a group that has been a group of, let's say, like people who have seen and believe in the power of psychedelic drugs, both to help people who are struggling with serious mental health conditions like end-of-life anxiety or treatment-resistant depression, but also people who are just looking to enrich their mental experiences through a psychedelic encounter. Mm-hmm. And they've been working around the country to find states that seem interested or that seem like fertile ground to advance this effort. And they brought this to Massachusetts. It's not a question that has like bubbled up in Massachusetts. It's not been on people's radars for a long time, though there are cities and towns across the state, eight of them, I believe, that have decriminalized some of these drugs already. So the yes side, you know, you think of people who either have experienced the benefits of these directly or who have seen some of the provisional, and I should say, like, there's some research here, but some about a lot of it's still anecdotal about the benefits of some of these drugs.
So what psychedelics would be included in this ballot initiative?
Yeah, so it's, and I think you should think of them in sort of two parts. The ballot initiative, you know, you said sort of limited legalization. It's pretty broad legalization. So we're thinking of five types of drugs. There's psilocybin and psilocin, that's magic mushrooms. There's mescaline, which most people know in the form of peyote. There's DMT, which is used in ayahuasca. And there's ibogaine, which is a bark or root, very sort of very powerful psychedelic drug. All five of those drugs would be legalized immediately to grow at home, to use at home, to distribute. You can share them. You can give them away. You can grow them and give them away to friends, give them away to strangers. That's all fine. What you can't do is buy them. There'll not be a store where you can go in like marijuana and say like, hi, you're a dispensary. I would like some ibogaine. No, that's not going to happen. But there'll be personal growth. And that happens immediately. And then over time, so that's the first half. The second half of this question is that over time, there will be facilitated centers. Think of it as like mental health centers or, you know, like spas where you would go and have an experience with one of these drugs, a facilitated experience with a licensed facilitator. These are not medical centers. They can't be medical centers because these drugs will still be illegal federally. But it, you know, it's like a half day kind of overseen experience. But again, that happens later. And the personal legalization happens immediately and covers all the drugs.
So I can see where there would be some issue with how it's regulated, right? Where somebody might think it's a good idea, but the fact that you can grow it at home and give it away might be a little too much for some, right? So is that where you're seeing some conflict in whether to support this or not?
I think some of it also comes from the various risk profiles of these drugs. Like ibogaine, for instance, is a drug. We spoke to a doctor who said to us, like, oh, nobody should use that without a defibrillator around. Mm-hmm. It has serious cardiac risks. But if you're using it at home or distributing it to people, like how many people have a defibrillator or know exactly what their cardiac risks are? Ayahuasca too has, you know, intense neurological, acute neurological impact on people that, you know, worries some in the psychiatric community. And that's for healthy people. Mm-hmm. Then there's a class of people who are already struggling with, say, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or substance use disorder. And for them, there are heightened risks of, you know, psychotic breaks, of falling into sort of additional substance abuse. Addiction and forms of addiction. So these are not physically addictive, but you can still have kind of psychological addiction to these drugs. So there's a range of risks attached to these drugs, and the way these risks may play out, especially in the sort of personal use space, is really not well understood.
Have other states passed similar initiatives, or are we the first?
So Oregon was the first, but they did something much narrower. Only psilocybin, so only one drug, and only in facilitated centers. And it gave communities the right to say, no, we don't want centers in our area. So a much, much narrower set of legalization. Colorado did something similar. They legalized all five for personal use, though they did ban the sharing of ibogaine. It was determined that was just sort of too risky. And then they set up centers, but centers just for one drug, centers just for psilocybin. So we're going further than either state in that we are allowing the sharing of ibogaine, but more broadly that we have center, we will eventually have centers for all five of these drugs. And centers means systems for industrial growth and distribution and, you know, like controlled distribution and regulation for all these drugs.
Federal law would still consider these drugs illegal, as you're saying. So would passage of this initiative put the state at risk of a federal lawsuit?
I would say maybe a federal crackdown more than a federal lawsuit.
Right.
But yes, that is definitely a risk moving forward. So far, there's been no interest from the federal government in any kind of crackdown in Oregon or in Colorado. But again, we've, you know, those have been in place for not very long, and we've had a Democratic administration. We won't always have a Democratic administration. And as administrations change, priorities change. So yes, there will be a risk. And, you know, it's possible also that we will sort of go too far and trip some concerns. Like one issue is about insurance coverage. You can imagine that with illegal drugs, insurers are not going to cover experience, your facilitated experience. But there is some language in the bill suggesting that maybe they could cover the, like, the treatment that you get alongside your psychedelic experience. And that's the kind of thing that might get the, that might raise hackles at the Fed, with the feds.
You mentioned the possible therapy center services. Does the ballot initiative have provisions for the state to collect any kind of tax on these therapy centers?
Yes. So there will be some revenue attached to it. It's not like marijuana where the amount of revenue is meaningful to the state budget and will help support other programs. It's going to be a small amount of revenue because this market is likely to be a lot smaller. And it probably will just go to the creation of the regulated system in place. So it's probably at best self-funding and not generating revenue for other priorities.
Have any medical professional organizations like the AMA expressed any opinion on this initiative?
I don't know about the AMA. The Mass Psychiatric Association, so the Massachusetts Psychiatric Association, is pretty much leading the no side. So they've come out very strongly on the no side. Mm-hmm. Now, there are obviously some psychiatrists who support it, some psychiatrists who have integrated it into their practice who believe in the sort of healing power of this experience. But the official body is on the no side.
So what are the key pieces of information you think voters should keep in mind when they're deciding on the legalization of psychedelic drugs?
I think for this one, you really want to think hard about the two parts of it and think differently about them, the personal use and the facilitated use. I think you want to think about, you know, the research and, you know, the degree of confidence we can have right now in what the studies have shown, which is some real benefits from some of these drugs, but not enough yet to have convinced the FDA, for instance, to approve any of these drugs. And then, you know, also about kind of freedom for individuals. Like there is an anti-paternalist kind of libertarian argument here that also says, like, why should the government be in the business of regulating which drugs I can use for my personal care if I choose? So, you know, there are a number of like philosophical and then regulatory issues that voters need to think about. It's, you know, some of these ballot questions are like one paragraph. Question one is three words, you know, or changes three words in the laws. Question two is a paragraph. This one's 30 pages of regulatory detail. It's complicated.
Yeah. All right. Question five, minimum wage for tipped workers. This initiative would gradually increase the minimum hourly wage an employer must pay a tipped worker over the course of 5 years. But tipped employees currently have to be paid the state minimum wage of $15 an hour, right? If you know, they can pay them as little as $6.75, but if the tips make up the difference. But if the tips don't make up a difference, they're paid $15 an hour now, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's the biggest misconception about question five. This is not a question about raising the minimum wage. Tipped workers, as you say, they get the minimum wage. They are guaranteed the minimum wage. There is no such thing as a sub minimum wage where they might go home with $6 or $7 an hour. It is exactly, as you put it, a question of who pays and whether tips count. Mm-hmm. Right now, the situation is that businesses can pay as little as $6.75 an hour, provided that the workers get $8.25 in tips. And if they don't, the business has to pay more. What the ballot question would do is say, no, this is still a bad arrangement. What we want is for the businesses to cover the full $15 over a period of time, and then workers can get tips on top of that. At least that's the first part of what the ballot question does. It would say, okay, if you run a business that relies on tip workers, and that's mostly restaurants. I mean, mm-hmm. I think in your head, you can think restaurants, that's sort of 2/3 to 3/4 of the workers, but also salons, manicures, pedicures, things like that. If you run one of these businesses, you will have to start paying your employees the full minimum wage yourself, and then they can get tips. That's part one. Part two is, but those tips, excuse me, you can now take them, pool them, and distribute them among the full staff, full non-management staff. So in a restaurant, you could take the tips and say, these tips no longer belong to wait staff. That has been the law. That has been the rule. You cannot right now take tips and give them to kitchen staff. But if this passes, you could. You can give them to kitchen staff. You can give them to your accountant. You can give them to anybody who is not a manager in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So there are two parts of this. And they've generated different kinds of opposition, and they're in a weird tension. And I think a lot of the sort of question about this ballot question comes in, like, what's the relationship between these two parts, and why do I need to support both of them? Why couldn't I just support one or the other?
Yeah. Employers would likely raise prices to cover the increase in labor costs, right?
Well, you can imagine if you're a business and your workers have been getting the minimum wage and you haven't been paying them the full minimum wage, that has felt for a long time like a kind of win-win for businesses, right? My employers are still making the money that they're entitled to. I don't have to pay them. Now I will, and that will change the labor costs, right? I have to pay them. So I said before on the Uber and Lyft question, like, that money's got to come from somewhere. And in the Uber and Lyft question, those are profitable companies. Some of that money could really come out of their profits. Restaurants are not profitable, or, you know, that's like a notoriously low profit, high failure rate industry. They don't sit on a huge amount of money that they can just kind of pay out. So the most likely thing is that money has to come from higher prices. Although the easiest response is just to have a service fee. You can imagine a situation now where, you know, the restaurant pays $6.75 and then there's an 18% tip and that covers the minimum wage. And if you can't do that anymore, what you could do is you have an 18% service fee. So that 18% service fee now can be used to cover wages. So instead of the 18% tip that was covering wages, you have an 18% service fee that's covering wages. Nothing really changes for the restaurant. And, you know, the current situation sort of goes on in this pseudo form. So I think that the most likely thing is that more and more restaurants will say the easiest way for us to cover this new cost is to introduce service fees. And then it'll be up to diners to say, okay, this service fee is a tip. Thank you. I'm going home. Or, no, I will tip on top of that. How much? I don't know. We'll try to figure that out.
So what does the research tell us about the impacts on tipped employees? Are they likely to see their income increase or decrease if the initiative passes?
So most states have a tip minimum wage set up like we do. 43 of the 50 states have it. That is where the employer doesn't have to cover the full amount. But it changes all the time. Like, it goes up, it goes down. And so there's been a lot of research in, like, what happens when states require businesses to pay a little bit more, to cover a little bit more of the minimum wage. And the research pretty consistently shows that workers end up earning more money. So the likely impact here is, yes, workers will take home more money. Now, the one caveat to this is we don't have a lot of examples of states eliminating or phasing out the tip wage entirely. All these studies are based on, like, let's increase the amount that businesses pay by $1 or $2. It's not, let's get rid of it. No state has gotten rid of it in decades. So we don't have a lot of good information about what happens in a phase out. The closest example we could find was Washington, D.C., which is 2 years into a 5-year phase out right now. Now, obviously, you know, it's all urban, so you don't get a good look at, like, geographically what happens. There's no area like the Cape in Washington, D.C., right? And it's a lot smaller than Massachusetts. So it's not a perfect example, but they're 2 years in. They've not seen any, like, big job losses or the things you might worry about, but they have seen an explosion in service fees. And the city council there, or city government, has had to push back in a couple of ways. They've had to limit service fees to 20%, and they've had to require transparency. Because one thing about service fees, at least with tips, there are laws around who gets them, who can get them. With service fees, there's nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, if the business wants to take the service fee and pocket it, that's fine. Like, legally, that's fine. So DC had to put in some transparency laws to say, like, okay, if we're gonna have these big service fees, let's make sure we know where it's going. It's going to the workers, whatever. Just have to be clear about it. Yeah. So I think if it happens in Massachusetts, we're likely to see the same kind of squabbling about service fees and probably some new regulations about how they can be used and what that money can go for.
So what should we be thinking about as we're deciding on this question?
So I think that, you know, the broad framework you should have in your mind is, yeah, it's likely to increase earnings for workers a little bit, not dramatically. Tip workers. It's likely to increase prices a little bit or switch to service fees. And then there's this question, the second part of it, like, why are we splitting the tips now? Or why are we allowing restaurants, not mandatory, but why are we allowing restaurants to split the tips? And this part of it has actually split wait staff a little bit on this question, right? Because there are bartenders, there are waiters, and not a trivial number. This is not like fake AstroTurf people that they trot out. There's a significant number of folks who don't appreciate this, who got into this industry because they like hustling for tips and don't want to share their tips with kitchen staff. So then there's this weird split among waitstaff in terms of support. And I think that's kind of weighing down the support for the ballot question overall.
Yeah. We got an email from Lindsay in Eastham. Another one says, I thought I'd done my research on all the ballot questions, but was surprised to find a seventh question on my mail-in ballot, which we talked about earlier. I can't find any information on this question online. What are the implications of a yes versus no? Can you help me understand the question, or at least point me in the direction of how I can research it?
Well, given this is the non-binding question, I think the right way to think about it is sort of like, you know, use your gut and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, because it's non-binding, right?
Yeah, not just that it's non-binding, but that you could imagine a situation where your legislators are very sensitive to non-binding referenda. They take them seriously, they listen to them, but that I don't think is the case. What they listen to is who votes for them when they go for re-election. So as long as you're electing these people, they are not motivated by binding referenda. They are motivated by their ability to maintain your vote. So I would not spend too much time thinking about how to vote on the non-binding one.
Right. Evan Horowitz is executive director of Tisch College's Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. The center provides nonpartisan research on the ballot questions, doesn't take positions on initiatives. We'll post a link to the center's research on all five of the statewide ballot initiatives at our website, capeandislands.org. Evan, thanks for taking time to be with us. Really helpful.
No,
appreciate it.
It's great, Mindy. I know these are complicated, and I appreciate being able to help.
Thanks for doing all the research. Coming up after break, we discuss question six that will appear on the ballot of Barnstable County residents. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing ballot initiatives this hour. Voters in Barnstable County will have a sixth question on the ballot, one that seeks to amend the fiscal provisions of the county charter. Joining us to discuss question six, Deputy Speaker at the Assembly of Delegates, Randy Potash. She's the Chatham Assembly Delegate. Welcome, Randy.
Oh, thank you so much, Mindy. It's an honor to be here with you and Commissioner Bergstrom.
And Ron Bergstrom, Chair of the Board of Regional Commissioners of Barnstable County. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Thanks for giving us this opportunity to try to educate people on this ballot question.
You bet. So before we jump into discussion on the ballot question, Ron, give us a quick explainer of the role of county commissioners. I know people get confused.
All right. County commissioners, and there are three of us, and we run countywide, so I run from Bourne to Provincetown. We're the executive branch of Barnstable County. We hire the administrator. We oversee the operations of the county government. I'm elected to a four-year term. My colleagues will be elected again this next November 5th, hopefully. And so we basically oversee the county government the way selectmen oversee the town government. They are the executive body of the county and basically make sure that the business of the county is well performed.
All right. And Randy, give us a quick explainer for the role of the Assembly of Delegates.
Sure. So the Assembly of Delegates is the legislative branch of the county. So when many counties were abolished back in the 80s, Barnstable County is one of the counties that remained because of the special needs of the special place we have here in Cape Cod. And the founders of the charter specifically refused to have a charter like some of the other remaining counties. Instead, they chose a special act charter with an assembly of delegates who, again, are the legislative branch. And we are the only county, at least in Massachusetts, and pretty much in this region of New England, that has such a legislative branch. And so we form ordinances based on our, you know, needs of our constituents, and we also respond to the ordinances set forth by the executive branch. We balance, you know, we make sure that the budget is appropriate, and we have powers to override vetoes if we think the budget is inappropriate.
Right. So this ballot question six seeks to amend the fiscal provisions of the county charter in several ways. This was proposed by the Assembly of Delegates, Randy. So tell us why, what the changes are and why this is being proposed.
Yeah, sure. So there's three ways to skin this cat of changing a charter. And the first way is the way that the Assembly chose, because what we would like to do is amend some of the language and not make any, you know, radical changes in the charter, because Section 9-1 of the charter allows for small changes. And again, they're really not changes what we'd like to see. What we'd like to do is clarify some of the language, because there used to be an advisory board that was provided from the different towns, and they would recommend ideas to the assembly, and that was abolished. And the language of the charter is confusing as to whether the assembly is a mere advisory board or not. And so there's some language that needs to be amended to show the what the assembly's role clearly is. We consulted with county council, and they agreed that this was an appropriate way to deal with this issue. They labeled the language that we saw as confusing as inartful. And so we went ahead and looked at some of the problems that we saw with language in the charter. Another aspect was that there weren't definitions as to certain roles of our actual advisory board, which is the Finance Committee. And so we, again, amended some language. I think it's really gotten blown out of proportion, unfortunately. This was a legal avenue in the charter to address some confusing aspects of language. We, again, consulted with counsel. They said this is a way. We sent it to the Secretary of State, and we formed a ballot question, and here we are.
All right. So, Ron, clarifying language, why opposing? What's in this proposition that you are opposed to?
Well, you know, Mindy, despite being promoted as some kind of housekeeping, you know, with changes in words here and there, let me read you what county council said when asked about this question. It says, "This does impact the division of powers between the executive and legislative branches of county government in meaningful ways. In my opinion, these amendments will expand the assembly's authority to substantially amend the county budget from what has been proposed by the executive branch." Now, it isn't clarifying, and it isn't about transparency. This is the result, unfortunately, of an internal county turf squabble that most people know nothing about. The assembly, you know, after operating under the same rules for 35 years, have decided they want to expand their authority over the budget. And when they got rebuffed by county council, and it was pointed out that what they're asking for is inconsistent with Massachusetts general law, inconsistent with how local legislative bodies operate, and inconsistent with how we've been operating for 35 years, once they were rebuffed, they said, well, we're going to go to the ballot. So, you know, the voters, as they vote for the president and the various offices that are on there and some important ballot questions, they have the right to ask when they come to question six, why is this on the ballot? How many people are really going to understand the implications of this? And even if they understand a little bit of it, how are they going to make an informed decision without any kind of public outreach process? I mean, I have great respect for the assembly. I served on the assembly for 12 years. I was speaker for 8 years. But we operated under a certain format, under a certain bunch of rules, and they worked fine. And right now, Barnstable County's financials are better than they've ever been. We got an upgrade in our bond rating. Our financial practices have been praised by Standard & Poor's. So really, it's a solution in search of a problem. And I don't understand why we don't go simply wait another year for a comprehensive charter review committee that'll reach out to the public, to public officials, to nonprofits, to the business community, have a series of public meetings, and if there are changes are needed in the historic and relationship between the executive and legislative branch, they can be determined then and go on the ballot in 2026.
Randy, why not wait for another year for a charter review commission?
Well, the reason why we don't want to wait is because the executive branch consistently denies the responsibilities that are trying to be carried out by the legislative branch. When we send over an ordinance or we change things, they often were ignored. And if we're not ignored, then we're labeled an advisory board. And this really came to a head during the APA division of monies. And we are trying to carry out the role in the charter. And we are tired of seeing taxpayer money spent on legal opinions saying that the charter says something different. And so there's going to be two more years of budgets and different ordinances, and we don't want to see any more money wasted on legal opinions that can simply be fixed by amending charter language that is inarticulate and inartful and out of step with how the founders of the county wanted it to be. I have a bicameral system of checks and balances, and the Assembly of Delegates is just simply trying to carry out the mandate that we were elected to do for our citizens. And, you know, the reason why, again, we don't want to wait until a full charter review, which we will do, is because we don't want to see any more money go out the door on unneeded legal opinions.
I've got about 3 minutes left. I'll give you each a minute and a half here to make your case to voters. So, Ron, go ahead. You go first.
Yeah, I'm an insider, and so is Randy. And we look at these issues, and they're complicated. But the voters are not going to have that benefit. They're going to look at this, and they're going to have very little information on which to make a decision. And we obviously disagree on the implications of this. But, you know, the reason that they complain about legal services is because they simply don't agree with county council. We have KP Law, which is one of the largest and most respected law firms in Massachusetts, that advises us when we come into a conflict. And if the assembly doesn't like what they're told, they simply say, well, we don't agree. We're going to go to the ballot and we're going to change things. I mean, that's what's cost us expenses. This to allow the assembly to, during the course of the year, raise, you know, put in more expenses or to lower the budget or raise the budget on a whim after it's already been put to bed in the spring, that's going to result in chaos. It's not going to solve things. It's not going to make things any easier. It's just going to make it worse. Unfortunately, you know, for the assembly, they can't initiate spending that we don't ask for. And even if they did, under the rules in towns and the rules in the county, we have the option of whether we want to proceed on what they ask for. That's just the way it's written, and I think it's a reason for that, and I think that the voters should respect that. If they want to change it, let's change it after a comprehensive public outreach.
All right. Randy?
Yeah, so this charter amendment just simply seeks to allow the Assembly of Delegates to perform its duties under the charter. The budget is governed by our Home Rule Charter, not by state statute. The county legislative powers belongs to the Assembly of Delegates, who are boots on the ground representing the people of our 15 towns. And if the people in our 15 towns feel that certain services are inadequate, we need to have a voice in putting forward ordinances. The ordinance process doesn't discriminate between the executive and legislative branch. The ordinance process is outlined in the legislative portion of the charter, and the Assembly of Delegates, again, is just simply trying to carry out its mandate under the charter, and these are simple amendments instead of taking the matter to court or to attorneys. We spoke to the founders of the charter. We read language that they had drafted to say that they wanted a special act charter with an assembly of delegates that have legislative powers. This is already in the charter. It's not any new powers at all. It's just to clarify the role.
Right.
And thank you.
All right. Thank you. Deputy Speaker of the Assembly of Delegates, Randy Potash, Chatham's Assembly Delegate, and Ron Bergstrom, Chair of the Board of Regional Commissioners for Barnstable County. Thank you both. And I know it gets confusing. We'll have a link with more information about the ballot questions at our website,
capeandislands.org.
Thank you both. I'm Mindy Todd.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Ron. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.